Good afternoon. We're here for our third case today and for the month of March. 98-1737 Douglas Hanson Company versus E.F. Goodrich. Mr. Hildebrand, will you be doing the oral argument or will you just, okay, representing B.F. Goodrich?
Thank you, Your Honor. With me at the council table is John Lunseth, who was the lawyer from the Ryder Bennett firm that tried this case. And after the trial was over, I was hired for the appeal. Then we worked on this together. I'm very pleased that this court decided to take this case because I think it represents very important public policy issues regarding the economic loss doctrine. As I'm sure you realize from reading the briefs, there has been a difference of opinion, at least in the federal courts, charged with the responsibility of predicting what this court would ultimately do with the issue of whether fraudulent inducement is covered by the economic loss doctrine or not. We are here today to ask this court to essentially adopt a middle ground as far as the public policy is concerned in the application of the economic loss doctrine toward the fraudulent inducement. The essential problem, I think...
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm going to.
That's all right.
What is the difference of damages between going in on a contract claim here and on economic damages? And then my second question, if you have to answer that one, is I don't know what you want. Your conclusion is about the economic loss doctrine, but I don't know what you expect of this court.
All right, well, I'll answer your second question first, if that's all right. At the trial, the plaintiff presented both a breach of contract and a tort theory. And at the end of the trial, the trial court ordered the plaintiff to choose between the two. And the plaintiff chose to assert the tort theory, and then the case was presented to the jury and the verdict through the traditional tort and instructions and form of the verdict. So there was a trial on the contract case, but there was never any decision on the contract case. And we think that the tort case should not have proceeded to the jury at all. And therefore, we are asking for this court to reverse the tort verdict and judgment and send it back to the trial court for disposition on the contract theory.
But does that mean it has to have a new trial?
Well, I don't know. I think that would be up to the trial court. Maybe it could be handled on a motion for summary judgment or whatnot, but it's fairly clear here that the plaintiff did not get a decision on the breach of contract claims that were made in this case, and I think I don't think I would be in a position to ask this court to just remand and have it be dismissed because they didn't get a verdict on these contract issues. And our theory all along is that this is a breach of contract case and it ought to be decided under contract
principles.
What kind
of damages would they get?
They would get expectation damages, traditional breach of contract damages. I think that...
So what would that mean in this case?
Well, I don't know how those would be measured, except that the plaintiff's lawyer, and I believe I cited that in the transcript, where the court at the time, the trial court at the time that, I think it's at... I think it's at page 61 of the appendix. Mr. Paysant, my distinguished opponent, says that the trial judge asked him the same thing, and he said, to the extent that under breach of contract cause of action, we will not be entitled to out-of-pockets, and there are representations that entitle you to out-of-pocket losses. And then the court goes on to say, well, then within misrepresentation, that's included, but then there would be some other damages. And that goes on over to page 62 of the appendix. and then the plaintiff elected the tort remedy and went for the higher damages.
I have a question on the facts.
What about my first question?
I thought you just answered.
Your first question was, I'm sorry.
I can't remember either.
Damages.
Right.
Oh, all right. Well, then I guess I've answered both of the questions.
Well, do you think there's a contract here?
Pardon me?
Was there a contract here?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
What was the agreement?
The agreement is found, it's a signed agreement, and it's found in the appendix. It's a fairly lengthy agreement.
What was Goodrich supposed to do?
Well, Goodrich was supposed to furnish product to Douglas Hanson for electronics.
How much?
There was no agreement as to how much product would be...
Didn't have to furnish any then.
That would be true.
So what else was Goodrich supposed to do?
Pay for the services that were performed on the product that it sent. And this is
if
a requirement. Uh-huh. This is a requirements contract in essence, and there's really nothing, I don't think, unusual about this form of a contract.
What do you mean by a requirements contract? That's a term that I'm not.
Well, a party will contract for someone to furnish or to provide certain requirements, and it can be zero, it can be a lot. But the contract specifies the terms, what will happen if requirements are, or if product is furnished, in this case for electric beam processing.
But it doesn't furnish a remedy for breach of contract if...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It doesn't furnish a remedy for breach if those requirements aren't met, right? Essentially, in this case, there was no breach of contract claim that could be forwarded because there was no obligation to provide any specified amount of work in exchange for the inducement to enter into the investment on the $1 million machine, right?
That would be our position, that the contract was not breached, but that was never determined by the trial court.
So in effect, the damages would be zero. That's your position.
That would be our position on the contract theory. If they could show
that was my first question.
Yeah, if they could show a breach, then they would have to.
But they can't show a breach because you didn't have to do anything.
Right.
That would essentially be our situation.
But
yes.
You still have a contract.
Pardon me.
You still have a contract.
Yes.
There can be no breach.
You don't have to do anything, and there's no breach if you don't do anything.
Yeah. You can still have a contract.
Yes, you can.
Could Goodrich have gone to another source?
Yes. That was spelled out in the documents both before and in the contract itself.
So they could have gone to really anyone they wanted to and bought any amount or nothing?
They were buying services. They were buying the curing of this adhesive. That's what this contract was about. Goodrich was manufacturing something that they wanted to furnish to the automobile industry.
Well,
and it had to be cured, and that's where Douglas Hanson came in.
That leads me to my third question. Why are we into the field of economic loss doctrine at all? We're dealing not with goods, we're dealing with services. And the UCC and the whole concept on product liability and where there's a commercial venture with the sale of goods, that's how the economic loss doctrine developed, right?
That's how it started. But I think as it's developed, it's a doctrine that applies basically to all contracts, regardless of whether or not they are covered by the UCC.
Hasn't it gotten out of hand?
No, I don't think it has gotten out of hand. I think it's an excellent doctrine that has solid public policy values behind it. And these public policy values have been wisely, I believe, articulated by this court in a series of cases. And
all of them involve goods.
Basically, yes.
Okay. Now, you say that it's good public policy. Tell me Your client agrees that it is guilty of intentional misrepresentation.
No, it does not agree.
Well, the jury's so bound.
I understand that.
Okay, so you're bound by that.
That's right.
All right. So you are bound by an intentional misrepresentation. What is good public policy about awarding zero damages to another company that has, the jury found, has been damaged to the tune of $1.8 million? So what's the good public policy on that?
Well, the public policy is not dependent upon what the jury found or did not find. Here is where the public policy comes in. First of all of the economic loss cases, this court has articulated public policy that it's important to distinguish between tort and contract. All right, now here we have two sophisticated commercial entities, both represented by counsel, who negotiate and enter into a contract that says there are no pre-contractual representations or warranties. Now, Your Honor, can you imagine sitting in the law office, if you were practicing law, and advising a client, and the client comes to you and says, look, Madam Lawyer, I'm going to sign this contract, but they told me something that they are unwilling to put in here. They made some representations to me, and I want these in the contract, and I see this clause that eliminates that. And I think most lawyers would say to the client, look, if you sign this contract, you can't rely on any pre-contractual representations.
I think I'd say to him, this is an illusory contract. I think it's awful. You want the business, you sign it. We'll see them in court if they goof.
Yes,
and that's what you would have told them, too.
Well, no, I'm not so sure I would have told them that.
Not
because,
so sure you wouldn't.
Well, but I don't think that two sophisticated commercial parties should enter into a contract as a setup device on a tort claim if the so-called injured party doesn't get what he expected to get based on pre-contractual representations.
One, how do we know Douglas Hanson is sophisticated, and how do we know Goodrich is sophisticated?
Well, we know that they had lawyers there. We know that they've both been in business for many years. Douglas Hanson is a very successful company, and it's kind of interesting. Justice Sykes asked about going out and purchasing $1 million worth of equipment on this. I would simply call your attention to footnote 2 in our reply brief, where it appears that the cost of the unit that they purchased was $682,000, and then to finance the entire line, Douglas Hanson went out and had that equipment, which they bought for $682,000, appraised at $1,350,000, and then they went out and expanded their line. I think the plaintiff here, with all due respect, is very sophisticated. And be that as it may,
would it matter if it was the Abrahamson newly incorporated company?
It would if you were dealing with the Dan Hildebrand company.
Well, does it matter? And does it matter if I were dealing with the B.F. Goodrich company here? Your argument would be the same.
Well, it depends on what the business footing is. Now,
same as here.
One of the
Abrahamson new company. Same case. And why would you say it's any different when we have a case that says that economic loss doctrine applies to consumer transactions?
Well, I know you and Justice Bradley dissented from that.
I'm now bound.
You are bound.
Bound but not bowed. That's
okay.
My new philosophy.
All right. Well, this is not a consumer case.
I know it's not.
And if you had a consumer case with Abramson Company, with you and your husband doing something out of your house,
or my husband, it's just me.
Whatever, okay. But then you've got public policy articulated in the Olerman case, which we, of course, contend doesn't apply to a situation like this at all.
Are you familiar with an Iowa Law Review article, Bucking the Trend, the Uniform Commercial Code, Economic Loss Doctrine?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, it's interesting, and it was article that says that the whole economic loss doctrine has been pushed farther than originally intended, and that the UCC, under which it initially started, didn't intend this at all, and that a fraudulent fraud and misrepresentation cause of action is okay. It happens to be done by some Minneapolis lawyers, and I hope that they have no relation to this case.
Not that I know of.
That satisfied my mind on at least that. Then there's the restatement that also indicates that this is a good cause of action.
All right. Well, let me tell you what the alternatives are for this court. First of all, if you go with the rationale of what is in the Budgetel case, which was followed by the Court of Appeals in this case, fraudulent inducement is always an exception. I would suggest to you that if that is the law, you might as well overrule Sunny Slope and some of these other cases, because all someone would have to do to defeat a warranty is say, well, they made statements before the contract, furnish an affidavit, and go to trial on fraudulent inducement because they were promised something over and above the warranty, or they wouldn't have gotten into it. This, as we say, would put tort law in such a primacy position over contract law that you would be affording people the opportunity to get out of their contracts by just saying that I was induced to enter into this contract because of something that was said before the contract was entered into. That would really be bad in a case like this where the parties have agreed that there are no pre-contractual representations or warranties.
I agree with what you say, and maybe I simply misunderstand the facts of this case. I wanted to get to that about 20 minutes ago. It's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the damages here that are claimed by Hansen occurred prior to the signing of the contract.
If the damages occurred, if they're claiming that they were damaged because they went out and bought this piece of equipment, they said in their brief for $1 million, but I think that was a good faith mistake. I think it was more than $600,000, as we pointed out. And the testimony was, Chris Hansen said, I bought that equipment because I had that contract. B.F. Goodrich signed the contract first. It wound up on Chris Hansen's desk. He ordered the equipment, and then he signed the contract. So that's the sequence of it, all within a matter of a week or so.
What, do you agree that if the damage occurred prior to the signing of the contract, the economic loss doctrine would not be applicable, at least with respect to the damages that occurred prior to the signing of the contract?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, because if there's a breach of contract, then of course there would be damages because of the breach, and I don't think the timing of the purchase of equipment would really make any difference.
Well,
I mean, I don't think someone could argue persuasively that because I bought the equipment just before I signed rather than just after I signed would really mean that there couldn't be recovery for breach of contract.
Maybe you're right with respect to the facts of this case, but it seems to me that at least in most cases, if an individual signs a contract and it contains the clause that is in here, you know, there have been no representations, and then incurs damages, there's no question that the economic loss doctrine.
That would be true, Your Honor.
But if, in fact, the damages occurred before this, let's say a year before, let's say if the facts of this case were that based upon representations made by B.F. Goodrich, a year before this contract was signed, Hansen purchased $1 million worth of equipment, and then nothing happened.
Well,
and it was based upon misrepresentation. Wouldn't the fraudulent inducement have occurred prior to the signing of the contract, and therefore the economic loss doctrine does not apply?
No, the fraudulent, the economic loss doctrine doesn't have really anything to do with the timing of when the damages occur. It's a device to distinguish really between whether there's a tort or a contractual or a contract remedy for what happened. Now, let's follow up on your example. Suppose B.F. Goodrich said a year before the contract was signed, look, we have this product and we think we're going to do business with you and et cetera, et cetera. And so Douglas Hanson goes out and buys $1 million worth of equipment, and then down the road, the parties don't agree to anything. Mm-hmm. What do we have? We have nothing.
Contract, but what if there was fraudulent inducement?
Fraudulent inducement to purchase the equipment without a contract?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think fraudulent inducement assumes that there's going to be a contract.
No.
And they're here.
The point is that if in fact, let's assume there was no contract signed here. Let's assume never a contract. Would Hanson have been able to recover for fraudulent inducement?
You can't have fraudulent inducement without a contract.
You can't.
No.
But what are the elements of fraud or misrepresentation? Let's say
there obviously, I think, or arguably could be a claim under the common law for fraud, but it wouldn't be fraudulent inducement.
Okay, I don't mean to say I wasn't using that term as a term of art. If I am fraudulent, if they, by use of fraud,
misrepresentation
got me to purchase $1 million, or got Hanson to purchase $1 million worth of equipment, and no contract was ever signed, certainly if they could prove misrepresentation, they could recover, correct?
Well, they'd have to prove a lot of other things. They'd have to prove reliance and all of that, and how could someone rely on a contract that was never signed, or if they were
not
talking about entry.
There was some kind of fraud, some kind of misrepresentation, and a jury finds it.
But the problem in this case deals with the difference between contract and tort in the context of fraudulent inducement, not whether...
Isn't that the issue? I mean, the issue is you're saying this is just a contract in essence, and the other side is saying in large part there is a distinction here. We have, following up on Justice Babbage's comment, a tort of fraud or a tort of misrepresentation in addition or separate from any contract. Therefore, under tort damages of fraud or misrepresentation, which are not intertwined but are distinct and separate, that there is recovery.
Well, that's what they're saying. But the question I think for this court is, are you going to allow parties who sign an agreement that say that there is no representations or warranties pre-contractual to come in after the fact and say, we were defrauded?
Take Justice Babbage's hypothetical. Never a contract signed. Is there a cause of action that can be maintained for misrepresentation?
Well, not on these facts, but on some hypothetical facts, yes.
What are the elements of, if you know, I don't know right now.
Yes, well, there has to be an intentional misrepresentation and reliance with intent to deceive and all of that stuff. It's well laid out in the law.
Isn't there a cause of action that can be maintained on these facts for misrepresentation?
I don't believe so.
Those elements don't
apply. We have here what we're talking about is a fraudulent inducement. That's what this case is all about.
But I think the
critical issue for this court is, are you going to allow people who sign contracts like this to come into court after the fact and assert tort remedies because they didn't get what they claim they were supposed to get? Not under the contract, but under something else.
What are the elements of fraudulent inducement as compared to the elements of fraud or misrepresentation?
The only difference is that with fraudulent inducement, there has to be the fraudulent inducement of a contract.
So if they had, Goodrich had said, listen, we're interested in this adhesive, you can count on us. When the rubber hits the road, you can count on us.
Yeah, I can't imagine that they would be able to get into it to a jury on that issue with those facts where a contract wasn't signed.
Counsel, the way it seems to me, you're portraying this as a fraudulent inducement to contract. And therefore, you'd win. But it seems to me that this, you can at least very arguably say this is a fraudulent, let's not say inducement, a fraudulent misrepresentation that caused damage prior to the contract.
But then they sign a contract that says there aren't any representations or warranties.
Well, are you pleading the parole evidence rule then?
Well, the parole evidence rule isn't available in the tort case. I do want to save some time for rebuttal.
You have time anyway. Justice Prosser has a question.
What is the middle ground that you're at?
The middle ground is I think, articulated, and thank you for asking me that because that's what I wanted to be sure I see. The middle ground is articulated in two federal decisions, Ice Bowl, which is 14F sub second at 1083, and Rich Products. We gave you a Westlaw site in our briefs, but that's since been published in 66F sub second 937 at 979. But there, those two judges articulated how these exceptions would work. And the exceptions relate to items that do not involve the performance of the contract itself. And it's a sensible place to draw the line so that people who are truly cheated outside of the contract have an appropriate tort remedy. But those who are really coming into court and claiming that they didn't get something that they could have negotiated for and didn't, or were unsuccessful in negotiating in the contract, don't come running into court and ask us to rewrite your contract for you. And that's what those exceptions are, and I would urge the court to look very closely at those two opinions by Judge Reynolds and Judge Randa.
I understand your position, and I would agree with your position. If they sign the contract, and then 3 months later, after signing that contract, they purchase a $1 million machine, and then P.F. Goodrich fails to deliver any goods to them, fails to give them anything, and then they come in and say, hey, this is a tort, I can recover in tort. And of course we'd say, hey, you signed this contract. And after you signed the contract, you did something, knowing full well that the promises of B.F. Goodrich were that they only had to deliver zero. But when the damage occurs before that, when the purchase of the machine is made before the signing of the contract, it seems to me, Counsel, you've got two different cases.
Well, let me help you this way, Justice Babbage. I'll try to be all the help I can. B.F. Goodrich signed the contract before Douglas Hanson purchased the machine. Douglas Hanson got the contract signed by B.F. Goodrich, purchased the machine, then signed the contract and sent it back. Now, why that should make a difference on the facts of this case, I don't know. It all happened within a 10-day period.
Justice Brown.
It seems to me that if we follow your argument, we may be engaging in what might be bad public policy. It seems to me that it's not good public policy to provide a safe harbor for parties who intentionally misrepresent in a commercial context or any context. Isn't that what we're doing? And I don't see how that can be consistent with public policy,
right,
providing
a
safe harbor.
Well, I'll tell you why I don't think that view represents good public policy, because when you have two commercial parties represented by counsel writing an agreement, the question is not whether somebody made some pre-contractual fraudulent statements to induce the contract, but whether or not judges and juries and ultimately this court is going to supervise these commercial parties to try to ascertain what was agreed to and what wasn't, what was induced, what wasn't, and all of that. The public policy says that when two commercial parties sit down with counsel and write a contract, don't come running to court and claim some pre-contractual misrepresentations under the guise that we didn't get something that we wanted to get or that we negotiated for. And if it were truly, truly important, Douglas Hanson could have said, you put that into the contract, and if it's not there, we're not going to sign. And that is articulated in some of the cases we cited in our brief. So this court has to make the decision. Do you want judges, juries, and ultimately this court to be reviewing commercial contracts about what was said before? And memories are vague and people have different views, et cetera, et cetera. Or do you want to force commercial parties to put it in writing? And I think the better public policy is to tell people, if you're going to make a contract, put it in writing, and don't come running off to us crying if you don't like about something that isn't there. So I know it's a hard public policy choice, but that would be our view of it.
It seems particularly hard in these facts when it's done beforehand.
I understand, Your Honor, and I know that there are arguments on this, and thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. You have several 5 minutes in rebuttal. We have Michael Gray, your motion, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor. My purpose here is somewhat limited. My name is Michael Gray. I'm a partner at Maple, Crowns & Moore. I am admitted to the state of Wisconsin. I am a Wisconsin resident and graduate of the fine institution down the street. I was admitted to Wisconsin in 1993. Judge Bablich was kind enough to move my admission to the bar. Scott is a graduate of the University of San Diego. He's admitted to the bars of California and Minnesota. He tried this case to conclusion in St. Croix County. It's my pleasure to introduce him to the court and request that he be moved or admitted to the court for purposes of this case.
Well, Mr. Gray, your motion's accepted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Pazant, and I represent Douglas Hanson Company. I guess initially I'd like to point out that what B.F. Goodrich is doing here is trying to get away with fraud by hiding behind a contract. And to clarify the factual record and the procedural history as to what happened, we pursued at trial both a contract claim and a fraud claim. And we didn't really specify it as fraud and inducement per se. And our argument on the fraud claim was, A, we had misrepresentations. And it's really important to understand what the claim misrepresentations were because they affect public policy considerations later on in my argument. One was, we proved at trial, and the jury found, that B.F. Goodrich deliberately failed to disclose facts and made misrepresentations that led us to believe that they had a commercially viable product that was ready to go to market and that they had commitments from customers to purchase, and that B.F. Goodrich was solidly behind this project. In reality, what we proved at trial was the product was still in developmental stage, facing major hurdles before it got to market, that the division responsible for the product was being considered for divestiture and might be sold off, and essentially, B.F. Goodrich wasn't behind the project at all.
Why shouldn't the responsibility be placed upon you to do the required due diligence before you make investments?
Well, in this case, my position would be that any amount of due diligence does not disclose deliberate fraud and omissions. In this case, we were specifically precluded for reasons of confidentiality, trade secret, and those sorts of reasons from getting information regarding the development of the product. B.F. Goodrich in its papers talks about the confidentiality agreement, and if you read that agreement, it specifically says that we're not responsible for the development, We're not entitled to any of that trade secret information. So we couldn't discover that. And the fact of the matter was, we had Douglas Hagee on the stand before the jury, a former B.F. Goodrich employee who was responsible for this project, that said he knew there were major hurdles that this project faced, but he told Douglas Hanson Company everything was on course, we're going forward.
Well, didn't you waive these arguments? Didn't Hanson waive these arguments when he signed a contract that recognized there were no other obligations other than what are contained within this agreement, and they have no obligations? I mean, at that point in time, it seems to me a lawyer should say, you know, you could be even, you might even be waiving fraud.
Well, no, I
just... You are waiving fraud.
No, I do not think Douglas Hanson waived these arguments for a couple of reasons. First of all, I disagree with their interpretation of the contract. If you read the contract closely, all along, B.F. Goodrich was floating out these. These are best estimates. In fact, there was testimony that they were saying these estimates are even low. In the qualifier, and what the testimony at trial would have been, and what the issue would have been on the contract claim, the qualifier was, we're not guaranteeing these estimates. Mr. Hanson's testimony at trial was, he understood that if B.F. Goodrich didn't hit those estimates on the dime, he couldn't sue them. And he understood that they might be off by some percentage, but he didn't testify that he thought they couldn't deliver him anything. The important thing here, too, is...
You didn't understand that. It seems pretty clear from subsection A to submit any... They're under no obligation to submit any specific number of samples. How do you misunderstand that?
I think...
I mean, that sounds to me like it could be zero, it could be 10 billion.
And it may have been. But if you're Mr. Hanson's shoes, it's a far different risk if he's going to go forward this contract when the product's in development, you don't know it's going to make it to market, and when the product's in development and they're telling you they have to get it to market within 6 months and you have to have your equipment in by that time in order for us to fill orders. So when Mr. Hanson sits back to look at the contract and assess the risk, and this is important because when you look at the public policy behind the economic loss doctrine, the main policy behind implementing that doctrine was that in the product scenario, parties can assess the risk if the product doesn't perform. Douglas Hanson didn't have that opportunity. It's a far different risk going forward when you have a commercially viable product ready to go to market, if it's going to go to market, and when you have a product in a developmental stage.
Well, counsel, let's assume I'm a purchaser. I'm a manufacturer of widgets. And you come to me as the manufacturer of widgets or whatever, and you say to me, look, you have some product. And so I agree, and you make me believe that you're going to really come forth with 50,000 units that are X factors that make up part of the widget. So I say, okay, that's great. Then I sign a contract that says there's no obligations expressed or implied other than what's contained within this contract, and I have not agreed to submit any specific number of samples. Now, are you saying that the economic loss doctrine does not apply to that? Maybe my example is not good, but do you understand this?
Right. Well, it depends, and from my view, I mean, we're talking about, too, I think there you're talking about whether they have performed. Here we're talking about whether they had the ability to perform.
You lied to me, you misrepresented to me, etc. And then you put in front of me this contract that says I have absolutely no obligation to perform. And I sign that contract. How can I, given that clause that says you have no obligation to perform, say, but, gee, you know, despite the language of this contract, he said 6 months ago that he was going to do this.
Well, I think this.
Would any court accept that?
I think the court should, for this reason. One of the fundamental principles of law in Wisconsin is that when one speaks the truth. And really, when you look back, the duty that we are arguing here is a common law duty to disclose facts. It's set forth by this court in the Alleman decision. It's set forth in the restatement second, section 551, I believe it is. And what it says, you expect them, that's a common law duty to disclose. And I would say that duty arises before the contract is ever entered into. and it's breached.
What was the misrepresentation here, exactly, that you're claiming?
The misrepresentation, there were several. First of all, we claim there was a misrepresentation as to the commercial viability of the product. In other words, Douglas Hanson Company was told the product is ready to go to market. We've got customer orders ready to go. They were led to believe that the minute your equipment's up and running, we're going to be backing you up with material to get it out the door fast enough. In reality, the product was still in experimental stages, was still going through its development, and was having what they defined as, quote, major hurdles. That was the first misrepresentation. They were also told that B.F. Goodrich was solidly behind this project and really wanted it to go forward, when in reality, the adhesive systems division that was in charge of this project was being set up for divestiture to be sold off, and the company wasn't behind the project.
But counsel, assuming those misrepresentations, I'm assuming they all took place, maybe more. Why isn't this just a malpractice case against the lawyer that told Mr. Hanson to sign the contract?
Well, first of all, that didn't come into evidence that the lawyer told Mr. Hanson to sign the contract. Mr. Hanson, I believe, testified that he had an opportunity to discuss it with his lawyer. But the reason it isn't is because if we wanted to, if this were a different type of contract, I could have moved to rescind the contract. Douglas Hanson Company could have. I would have proved every element of fraud that the jury found, intentional misrepresentation, reasonable reliance. And really what you're arguing here with me, and what Mr. Hildebrandt is arguing, is reasonable reliance. Reasonable reliance was an issue presented to the jury. They made all of their arguments about this reasonable reliance. Look, you had a contract, they wouldn't guarantee it and whatnot. And the jury held, made a factual finding, as they're entitled to do, it's their job, that we reasonably relied. They also make this big argument about commercial parties. Well, that's all relevant. Douglas Hanson Company is a Hammond, Wisconsin company that does $20, $25 million in revenues a year. B.F. Goodrich is a huge international company that does $2 plus billion a year in revenues.
Well, let's focus on, can I back up a minute to your reasonable reliance claim? And I'm tracking on that, and that is a critical issue here. Why isn't it unreasonable as a matter of law for a party to rely upon alleged misrepresentations that it has later in a contract bargained away, essentially, by saying there are no other representations that are outside of this contract? Why shouldn't that be unreasonable as a matter of law?
Well, I think you have to look at each case scenario, and the jury found that it wasn't unreasonable. I don't think it is unreasonable as a matter of law when you have a multinational corporation telling you facts about the development of a product and where it is. And, you know, the contract doesn't discuss the equipment, and we're getting into, I mean, what our basic argument on the fraud was, you fraudulently induced us to buy the equipment. There was a cover letter that says we won't enter into the contract if you don't buy the equipment, essentially. But I analogize this more to an investment type of a situation. If they're asking Douglas Hanson Company to essentially invest in B.F. Goodrich by spending money to go forward on a venture, and they didn't come forward with full disclosure. Now, if I'm starting up a company and I come to any of you and don't make full disclosure to encourage you to invest money, it's clearly fraud. It's clearly fraud, no matter what the disclosures are, if you don't disclose material facts. And I think the other reason is the contract doesn't come into issue because the contract really is void. The fraud happens before the contract. The contract is void. Or
Mr. Payson, did you ever make any claim that the contract was void or voidable? Was that part of your pleadings before the trial court? Because weren't you proceeding on a contract remedy until the very end when you elected to go on the tort claims?
No, we did not make a claim that it was void and try to rescind, because if we rescinded the contract, we still were damaged, which we proceeded on, and I argued that we should have been allowed to present both claims to the court. We proceeded on a theory of fraud. We alleged the misrepresentations that I've told you about, and that we have met our burden of common law fraud, and essentially argued that the contract in reality was further evidence of the fraud because it showed that they had been making these types of misrepresentations. In addition, we proceeded on a breach of contract theory. And our argument on that was that to the extent they claimed that there were absolutely no requirements at all, it was an illusory contract, and that to give it any real meaning, they had to look to parole evidence, and the parole evidence was that B.F. Goodrich had to deliver material.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, rely on the idea that this was a void or voidable contract?
That was one of the arguments that the Court of Appeals made, as I understand their opinion. One of the
But it's my understanding that you never claimed that. You never said it was a void or voidable contract. You went on breach of contract theory until the time the judge had you elect one approach or the other at the time of the instructions conference.
But we pled in the alternative, which you're allowed to do.
Well, of course.
And we pled fraud. And under the fraud claim, that they're making misrepresentations, in other words, the contract would be void. We also pled fraud in the inducement. And we pled breach of contract. And we pled them all in the alternative. Judge Needham, in the part of the transcript that Mr. Hildebrand referred to, when he was forcing me to elect, I said, Judge Needham, we should be allowed to go to the jury on both claims. He disagreed. He said, well, are there any damages for your contract claim that you couldn't get in your fraud claim? And I said, no, because fraud in Wisconsin get the benefit of the bargain. It would include all the types of damages you would also get in a breach of contract claim. He forced us to elect, so we elected fraud. That's how the procedure went. I don't believe that we have to claim that the contract is void. What the Court of Appeals decision, I think what their logic was is this. The economic loss doctrine stems from the contract. So you have to have a contract. In fraud and the inducement, the fraud has to happen before the contract is entered into. So how can you force a party that proves fraud and the inducement to be limited to contractual damages that could have been, when the contract could have been voided or is voidable? It makes no sense. And then when you back up to the whole public policy behind the economic loss doctrine that the Chief Justice referred to and is discussed in the Iowa Law Review, originally it came from the UCC. If you read the UCC provisions at 1103 with 2721, they clearly anticipated that fraud causes of action would be maintained. It wasn't mentioned like that. It was in the product liability. What was happening was you had strict products liability and negligence in product cases.
But you don't take the position that the economic loss doctrine to cover situations such as this, do you?
I think some courts have expanded it, and I think they've done so improperly when it goes outside of a product case. In a product case where you're talking about a warranty, if I decide to buy a widget, and the seller says to me the widget will do A, B, and C, and I get the widget and it doesn't do A, B, or C, I can sue them for breach of warranty. And that may be an innocent misrepresentation. It makes all the sense in the world in the product case. And the reason the economic loss doctrine came about was because of the strict liability and product liability, courts didn't want to apply that strict liability when there were only economic losses. And now it's been expanded way far beyond. And I think when you talk about fraud claim here where we proved every element, and, you know, Mr. Hildebrand argues about this floodgates argument. Well, I've only been practicing 9 years, but most people told me when I was going to trial in a commercial fraud case that that's nuts. It's almost impossible to prove. You've got heightened standards, harder burdens to meet. It's, you know, no one ever admits fraud. You have to do it on circumstantial evidence. There are a lot of protections for a fraud claim. We survived summary judgment. We won at the trial with post-verdict motions. We proved fraud. And ultimately, they're saying it's okay for you to intentionally defraud somebody as long as you get a contract. And that's just not right.
But counsel, that's assuming that fraud took place, as we can hear.
Correct.
But aren't you opening up the door to any time a person doesn't like what's ended up in the contract to take their chances with the jury by alleging fraud? And then, even though the contract says, hey, there have been no obligations expressed or implied, and it's drafted so that it's, you know, it says anything that occurred, anything that was said, anything that happened prior to the signing of this contract doesn't count, and the only promises are contained within this document. No matter how tight you drafted that contract, under your theory, you could explode it.
Well, I don't think you would be able to explode it in every case. I mean, first of all, under the fraud causes of
action. No, but you could try, and if we go with you, we'd have to say, okay, when fraud is alleged, you've got to go behind the contract.
Well, not necessarily. You have to say you have to meet your burden of proof on the fraud claim, which means you have to prove an intentional misrepresentation was made, that it was made with the purpose to make you act in a certain way. If it's a fraudulent inducement claim, it was made to induce you to enter into the contract. You'd have to prove that you reasonably relied. The contract can be put into evidence on the reasonable reliance. Like you, it's my opinion that's a fact question for the jury. And it's my opinion that Judge Needham found that in the Court of Appeals, and they properly did so.
But counsel, if I lied to you, I sold you 15 big rockers, and then in order to get you to do something, but you didn't do it. Then the next day, I put down in front of you a contract that said anything that I said to you yesterday doesn't count. And then you do this.
Well, sure, and you could have people, what would happen, you could have people say, well, we're going to have to write in the clauses into the contract that you represent that you haven't defrauded me. But I think what we're missing here is, you know, a fundamental premise of the law is that when you speak the truth. When you're negotiating with someone, you negotiate fairly, and you disclose material facts. And no amount of due diligence that you do is going to disclose deliberate fraud.
But contracts are also very sacred things within the law.
Right. Well, let me twist it around on you, if I may. If you go with the, quote, middle ground, and I frankly disagree that there is any middle ground, because what is the middle ground is essentially that some fraud inducement claims are okay, but other fraud inducement claims are not. And if you read the Ice Bowl case and the Rich Products case, they try to go down the slippery slope of whether or not the representations or misrepresentations are interwoven with the contract. Well, if you're bringing a fraud in the inducement claim, the representations are by themselves, self-evidently, going to be interwoven with the contract. Because if you look to the definition of what a fraudulent inducement claim is, it's making misrepresentations to induce you to go into the contract. So in other words, you'll end up with a situation where companies, large companies like B.F. Goodrich, can take advantage of smaller companies like Douglas Hanson Company, who don't have the negotiating strength that they do, despite they say we're on equal footing. And they can lie and do whatever they want, and then cover themselves with a contract.
Is the inducement, I'm looking at your summons and complaint, the inducement that I see set forth in the summons and complaint is an inducement to purchase the equipment.
Right. And that's been a contention, and we've argued and disagreed about that. Because of the time constraints, B.F. Goodrich wanted this to happen quickly because they were telling us they had to get to market. We had to decide, are we going to go purchase this equipment? And we had this contract negotiations going on. And in the interim, we're talking about what equipment can we buy, can we get it in place? And our argument at trial was that that's what we relied on. And that's what the inducement was to buy the equipment.
Well,
we lost.
Because part of the discussion here is whether this misrepresentation or fraud is part of the contract or separate from the contract. The verdict that went to the jury says, did B.F. Goodrich make untrue representations of fact, knowing it was untrue or recklessly, without caring whether it was untrue, and with intent to deceive and induce to act upon it. Now, the allegation in the complaint is the inducement is induced you to purchase the equipment.
And that's been my position all along on behalf of Douglas Company.
Which seems to me that's separate from inducement to enter the contract.
Correct, and that's what I've argued in my briefs all along, that this is a totally separate and independent tort. What B.F. Goodrich counsel has done is argue that no, it's all interwoven with the contract because they put this cover letter on that said we won't enter into the contract if you don't purchase the equipment. And so, you know, we've gotten into this argument over the facts as to whether it happened earlier rather than later.
Do you have any cause of action that deals with fraudulent inducement to enter a contract?
I don't know if it was specifically pled as a fraudulent inducement to enter into a contract. I believe it was pled as a straight common law fraud claim.
Yeah, breach of contract, straight.
And a straight fraud claim.
Breach of contract.
And I think that's where the confusion gets in here, is because what we're trying to do is expand the law of the economic loss doctrine into what is a common law fraud claim, just because the parties ultimately had a contractual relationship.
How would this case be analyzed if Douglas Hanson had not bought the big
If Douglas Hanson had not bought the equipment, I don't think we would have ever gotten to this point, because the real damage to Douglas Hanson Company was going out of pocket for this coder line. We would have had a breach of contract claim. I think we can argue about the merits of that and never made it to the jury. We don't know what would have happened. But the real hardship, if you will, that we put on evidence of a trial was Douglas Hanson made substantial expenditures, and B.F. Goodrich knew that it was a highly leveraged company, that it needed guarantees, that this was not going to be an easy thing for it to do, and it stood by and let Douglas Hanson do that without giving them the full facts.
Could I ask you, use the phrase a highly leveraged company, could you respond to Mr. Hildebrand's statement about how equipment was bought at, what, $600,000 or something, and then higher amount, and then also, how did you get the purchase price of the equipment to $1.8 million in damages?
Okay, here's what I presented to the jury. I can't tell you exactly how they came up with $1.8 million because I was not in the jury room. The evidence that went in was, I believe that we had spent about $700,000, and then there were some other incidental costs regarding putting it in place that we argued brought it up to about $1 million. Mr. Lunseth argued it really wasn't really that. Mr. Lunseth came up with what I thought was a rather ingenious argument that we were doing all of this to create some equity so we could finance a new line. But we had our financer there, Matt Caratero, and the bottom line, Mr. Caratero said, was we look at revenues. We're not in the business of loaning money to foreclose on things. And that was not, there was evidence that that wasn't our intent. They argued that we purchased this equipment, we got such a good deal, there was equity, and then we used that equity to borrow against to get newer equipment. Our banker, if you will, Mr. Caratero, came in and said, well, they were looking at revenues. And another reason, when you get back to the reasonable reliance, it's just as an aside, B.F. Goodrich made representations to Matt Caratero, our banker, at a meeting, which was another reason why we thought they were telling the truth. And we put in evidence on that.
When did these damages occur, before or after the contract was signed?
Well, I believe the time frame was pretty close to what Mr. Hildebrand said, as far as we were negotiating with RPC to get this used piece of equipment. And we were negotiating how to get it refurbished and that sort of thing. And we had it all lined up when, I believe, when Mr. Hanson got a letter from B.F. Goodrich saying, basically, if you buy the equipment, we'll enter into the contract. Mr. Hanson, this was like on January 30th, Mr. Hanson had to do a purchase order by January 31st or something like that for RPC to agree to get the equipment to him by a certain day. He signed off on the purchase order, sent it in to buy the equipment. He subsequently signed the contract, but it was sort of a...
And when was the contract signed?
I believe Mr. Hanson signed it in early February. So it was about a 10-day, two-week period, end of January, beginning of February, is the chronology. But the evidence of trial was also that B.F. Goodrich representatives were involved with the decision to purchase the equipment, were in touch with RPC prior to that.
Can I go back to how you measured your damages?
Right. We put in out-of-pocket costs on the equipment, which was approximately, I think approximately $1 million.
Okay.
And then there was some evidence at trial, and I think Mr. Lentz argued it really should be about $600. We also put in damages because in Wisconsin you get the benefit of the bargain as to what things would have been if it had been true. And we put in lost profit analysis saying that if things had been as represented, if they had product, we would be entitled to lost profits. And I think we asked for approximately 1.4 in lost profits, and we gave the jury several numbers based on their estimates of what they were telling us they thought they could do.
Okay, so you had an expert witness who came in and said this deal was worth X as represented and Y as it ultimately turned out. And so that's our baseline measure of damages.
Right.
The benefit of the bargain measure of damages. And then you got to your consequential.
Yeah. What we said is, we said it cost us X amount of dollars to purchase the equipment and get it installed. And then we put on evidence that now the equipment was basically not worth very much money. So we said you had to back whatever the scrap value of the equipment was out that we could sell it for. So that was one portion of our damages. Then we said under the benefit of the bargain rule in Wisconsin, we're also entitled to lost profits that would have been the benefit of the bargain. And we put on evidence of the types of profits we would have made had things been represented like B.F. Goodrich said they were represented. And the jury came up with $1.8 million based on, I assume, giving us some portion of lost profits and some portion of lost money in the equipment. I mean, those are the damages I blackboarded, if you will.
Counsel, what is wrong with my position? Right now, what I'm feeling, what I'm sensing is this. If this is going to be my position, I want you to respond. That any damages that were incurred prior to the signing of the contract are recoverable. But once you sign a contract like this, that essentially says there's no other obligations expressed or implied. You're big boys and girls, and you're waiving all of them. And so as a result, anything that occurred after you signed that away, you're stuck to the benefit of the bargain.
Well, I'd say the fatal flaw in that analysis would be this. With one stroke of your pen in issuing that opinion, you would increase the transaction costs in every commercial transaction. Because now, rather than taking a company like B.F. Goodrich that has a good reputation, that you have no reason to believe would defraud you and is being upfront with you and wants to do a deal like this when you're a smaller company and going forward with it, you say, well, no, I have to negotiate representations, I have to do this. The contracts will become, you know, 10 pages long, single space, small type. And you'll be essentially defeating the purpose of the economic loss doctrine, which was essentially to make things more efficient and contractual contracts easier to negotiate. And I think you also would just be overlooking one of the most basic tenets of law, which is that you don't defraud people.
Well, it seems to me that you're asking us to read this last clause on 821 entirety, which says that you all agree that there are no contracts, understandings, conditions, warranties, or representations, oral or written, express or implied, except those that are written here. Nothing is, except if it's here or it's merged with another document. You're saying, in effect, I think, that that's true. As to any representations, conditions, warranties that are not fraudulent. But that if it is fraudulent, if there's a misrepresentation, if there's a fraud on you, then it's not covered here. This only covers truthful things because you don't expect parties to a contract to misrepresent. And if they do, they ought to be held to their misrepresentations. That's in effect your argument, I think.
I think so, and I think it's a reasonable argument for this reason. If I asked you to sign that, if I asked you to put yourself in the shoes of Douglas Hanson Company, and you sign that clause when your understanding is they've got a commercially viable product that's going to be sold in 6 months, and you're going forward, why do you have to be worried about that provision? You're assuming that I think you have, as a commercial party, you're not being unreasonable to assume that the party you're dealing with is not going to lie to you, and it's reasonable to assume that they'll disclose the facts. In fact, earlier, Chief Justice, you gave the hypothetical of, I believe, of something to that effect, which is, I mean, the law, as I understand it in Wisconsin, is that you're obligated to disclose any material facts relevant to a transaction. And if someone came into me as their lawyer and said, if I sign this contract, am I losing my fraud claim if they haven't disclosed all material facts to me, I would have said, I don't think so, because you have a claim for fraud.
Well, that argument, I think, was accepted in the Stoughton Trailer case and in the Budgetel-Inns case.
Correct.
That would say that that clause does not cover intentional misrepresentation.
Right, and I think it's important to understand that that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about negligent misrepresentation. We're not talking about innocent misrepresentations. You can have a person give a warranty and innocently breach the express warranty. Having someone deliberately defraud somebody as to a warranty is an entire different situation. And by accepting the middle ground that I argue is not really a middle ground, but I say you're simply doing away with any fraud claim, and you're basically telling companies it's okay to lie if you don't get caught before you sign a contract.
Aren't you really saying that, I mean, fraud doesn't really occur until there's been damage? I mean, nobody's been harmed by fraud until there's been damage.
Right.
And so it seems to me that signing of the contract could be the biggest whopper ever told. But then when you put in front of this person a piece of paper that says, ignore these whoppers, isn't that really what we're dealing with? And that's what you're saying, that no matter what you say, you can ignore whoppers?
But you know, that's not exactly what they said. I mean, it doesn't say, you know, you're taking the risk that we haven't disclosed everything. It doesn't say you're taking the risk that we lied to you. I mean, the clause doesn't say that.
Well, they could have put in a clause that said, even though there may have been intentional falsehoods or misleading statements, we are not to be bound by them or liable to you in any way for them. We could put that in a contract.
And I would submit to you that no lawyer in their right mind would ever let their client sign that. How can you enter into a transaction when you don't know whether you've been given correct information? And that's why there's a common law duty that one who speaks must speak the truth, because you have to have that fundamental premise in order for parties to negotiate fairly so they can fairly assess the risk. I know I've passed my time. I'm happy to field any.
I don't see any questions. I should also advise you, as I look to my empty seat, that Justice Wilcox will not be participating in this case. Thank you, Mr. Payson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hildebrand, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. There's a couple of factual matters that I would just like to call the court's attention to. There was a confidentiality agreement which was dated July 21, 1993, and the relevant parts are at appendix page 33, where B.F. Goodrich says that there are no obligations to submit samples, to commercialize any evaluated samples, or to give exclusivity to Douglas Hanson if any experimental sample is commercialized. The fact that this was experimental was all over the place. But what was really important is that in November, when Douglas Hanson was trying to obtain financing, they came, B.F. Goodrich participated in a meeting with the lawyers and financiers and absolutely refused to make any commitments either to help on the financing or to make purchase commitments. And indeed, right after that meeting, B.F. Goodrich was told by Douglas Hanson's attorney that B.F. Goodrich is the weak link in this process. Now, it is true, of course, that as my opponent argued, that no one should be allowed to make misrepresentations, and that's not the point here. The point is that is that if there's a contract and you have these kinds of discussions before the contract, people can have different recollections. People hear what they want to hear. And then you get the case before a jury, and the jury believes one and not the other. And you can't dispose of the case on a motion for summary judgment, because the trial judge will say, well, there's issues of fact here. And then when you get to the jury is instructed, well, who do you believe, and then make your verdict accordingly. And what we're arguing here is that with this kind of a contract, the parties ought to be bound by it so that the courts and juries don't have a supervisory review over all of these commercial contracts.
So basically then the situation would be that there can never be any actionable business fraud claim in the context of any business deal which involves a contract with the merger clause.
No, that's not true. I think that, as I said in answer to Justice Prosser's questions, there are some exceptions which do not deal with the essence of the contract or the performance thereof.
Can you hypothesize one?
Yes. Suppose you enter into a contract with someone who says, I've got insurance, and he turns out that he doesn't. Or you enter into a contract with someone who says, I'm dealing with you as an individual. It turns out that there's a corporation involved. All of this has nothing to do with the performance, but provides an essential reason as to why you entered into it.
If there's a written contract with a merger clause,
yes.
Your position would be that's still actionable.
Yes, because
it doesn't go to the performance of the contract itself.
That's exactly right. And here you heard my opponent say that when he argued the case before the jury, he was asking the jury to award him or his client the benefit of the bargain. I heard that phrase several times. So we're not dealing with a case of just pure common law fraud as if there were no contract. The other thing is that the contract itself requires Douglas Hanson to have the necessary equipment, supplies, et cetera, and Mr. Hanson, Chris Hanson, testified that he bought that equipment in reliance on the contract. We cited his testimony in our brief. So this is really a contract case, nothing more and nothing less. And because of the fact that the jury found Mr. Hanson more credible than B.F. Goodrich's witness, we have a very large verdict, including punitive damages. And when my opponent talks about transactional costs, I just think that it casts an enormous burden upon the courts if you're going to adopt the position of the Court of Appeals and what my opponent says you should, that fraud in the inducement is always an exception to the economic loss doctrine.
Counsel, last year we decided a case where I think we said economic loss doctrine applies not only in commercial transactions but also to consumer transactions.
Right.
So let me give you the door-to-door salesman. Listen, this blacktop is going to be swift fine. You know, if I order a new roof, special for you. And just sign here. This roof will last 20 years. It's going to be made of gold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the contract has a merger clause. How should we as a court rule on that?
You're governed by Olderman.
Pardon?
Olderman. That's your answer to it. It's Olderman.
Give me the answer then.
The answer is that if you're dealing with a consumer transaction, like an Olerman involved an unsophisticated purchaser of real estate.
Well, but I don't know. Last year when we said that economic loss doctrine applies to consumer transactions as well as commercial transactions, we left open questions like the court did not decide whether parties of a, how it applies with parties of unequal bargaining power. So I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure where we go with this, well, if we call your argument.
Well, to paraphrase Shakespeare, I'm not here to bury Olderman, but to praise it. I think it's a good decision.
I think so too. I wrote it.
Yeah, I know.
But suppose it had an entirety clause in it. Just like this, or what you call the merger clause.
If it's a consumer transaction, then I would say that Olerman would govern, because Olerman is not grounded upon the terms of the contract, but it's grounded on public policy notions of protecting consumers. Another exception, of course, is the tort of bad faith for insurers. That's grounded on public policy. Then you have exceptions for public safety, like the Northridge case.
You're going to allow a tort in a consumer contract case.
That's what Olerman says.
Well, I don't know about that. I haven't reread that case. I just know our State Farm case last year opened up economic loss doctrine to consumer.
Well, the problem in that case, I think, was one essentially of pricing, that if you allowed a consumer to overcome an automobile warranty, then, you know, the car companies would have, but the premise that we,
as I recall, concluded is that the economic loss doctrine applies to consumer transactions. That was I understand it to be a holding in the case. That's your understanding, too?
Well, that's what the opinion said. Yes.
Well, sometimes I have these crazy understandings because the opinion says.
Well, it's hard to write opinions and briefs and everything else, and we all struggle with that. But anyway, I do sincerely appreciate your listening to my argument.
One the essence of your argument is this, that notwithstanding the fact that B.F. Goodrich is an enormous, highly reputable company, that they cannot for any misrepresentations they make, fraudulent misrepresentations, and that someone who does business with B.F. Goodrich is a fool if they don't protect themselves in the contract.
No, I'm arguing that what we have here, this could happen to any company.
Absolutely.
This could happen to any company. It has nothing really to do with B.F. Goodrich, except they have this large and, we believe, unfair verdict against it. What we are arguing is that if you enter into a contract and you want something, you want some performance, you put it in there. No difference if it's a product or services. If you want a warranty, get it. And if that's important to you, put it in. Don't sign a contract with an entirety clause and then come running into court and say, but I was promised this, and I was promised that, and I thought this, and I thought that. And the reason is because you go to court, and instead of looking at the contract and what the parties agreed to, you hear what Chris Hansen heard and what he thought, and you heard what the B.F. Goodrich people said and what they thought, and the jury is trying to sort all of this out, and they believe one side and not the other. They could have believed us. The case would have been over. Do you want to allow someone, and this is the vice of the Court of Appeals decision, if you agree with the Court of Appeals that fraud in the inducement is always an exception to the economic loss doctrine, which is the position of my opponent, there's no more economic loss doctrine because it can be easily avoided by a simple affidavit, as it says in one of the cases we cited in our brief.
Can I follow up just briefly,
yes,
and I hate to extend this, but your position basically is that you're stuck with your contract remedies, right?
That's right.
And those remedies are you affirm the contract and sue for breach, right? Or you sue for rescission of the contract, and then what is the measure of damages under those circumstances?
Well, they didn't rescind, but we all know that that a fraud would provide that.
That's why I'm getting to that, right.
But the remedy for rescission is completely different from breach of contract because, and in here, there was no rescission because I think that Douglas Hansen decided that they wanted to get expectation damages.
Right, I understand it, and that's why I'm asking the question that I am. If we're going to say, you know, as a matter of the law of this state, that under these circumstances, that this sort of a business commercial transaction, you're stuck with your contract remedies, those include affirm the contract and sue for breach, in which case there's a certain measure of damages, or sue for rescission, claiming you were defrauded into entering into this contract in the first place, therefore it's void, and then what is the measure of damages? Out-of-pockets consequentials?
Yes, out-of-pockets would be the rescission matter of damages, okay. And I think that's one reason, one point of confusion in the Court of Appeals opinion where they talked about void, and but that was, as my opponent agreed, was not at issue in this case.
Right. So a party who is defrauded under these circumstances is not left without a remedy.
Absolutely
not. They can sue for rescission of the contract and recover their consequentials. They just don't get benefit of the bargain.
Yeah.
Future lost profits.
They can't.
Out of the deal.
Yeah. They can't have their cake and eat it too.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel. That concludes our arguments for today. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.